Welcome to The Brains Behind It, the official podcast of BrainHackers.com. The source for smart strategies to improve your life, one brain hack at a time. In this podcast, we talk to the leaders and innovators behind great organizations and find out the secret to their success. Here's your host, editor-in-chief of BrainHackers.com and two-time Guinness record holder for memory, Dave Farrow.
Hey there, brain hackers. We're going to talk about the brain and education today. I'm talking with Philip Cicero, and he is the author of The Seven Deadly Sins of the K-12 Education System. It's a mouthful of a book, but you know what? It really resonates with a lot of people. I've struggled with trying to get the academic, the K-12 system to really take new technology into account. Not computers and iPads, but actual learning technology like neuroscience. And he's got some stories as well of just how the system seems somewhat flawed, or at least to really resist change, at least until recently. Hey, Philip, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm doing good. Okay, so just for viewers who don't know my background, and you can say your background in a moment, but the reason why I'm so interested in the subject is because I'm known worldwide for my memory. I developed the Farrow Method, a method for improving memory. It's now an academic enrichment program for students, and every student who goes through it, who applies it, has tremendous gains. We've gotten people who they say they would never have been doctors and lawyers if it wasn't for this program helping them through college, students being prepped so they can enter college and everything. I feel great about the doctors. I don't know how I feel about the lawyers. It all depends until I need one, I guess. But I'm just one, part of a whole world of neuroscience, cognitive neuroscience that we know works. And yet the system has really, really resisted change and also embraced some weird quackery ideas of education like tabula rasa and things like that over the years. So that's my bias. I'm saying it right off the bat. I was 16 years old when I spoke in front of the Royal Commission on Learning in Canada, trying to get them to incorporate study skills into the curriculum. 16 years old, 43 right now, and it still hasn't happened. It is a lifetime of just pounding on a door, pounding your head against the door, and the parents are begging for this stuff, but the system's not doing it. So tell me your experience and your frustration that caused you to write this book.
Yeah, well, again, as you said, my name is Phil Cicero, a retired school superintendent. But I went through the typical, career path, if you will. I started out as a teacher, subsequently an administrator on the local building level, then the district level, and then became a school superintendent. And during that time, I got my doctorate at New York University and became very interested in bringing change to the educational system as an educational leader.
So all of those dreams weren't drummed out of you by then? Like, you were still optimistic?
I still had hope. I was a lot younger than I was now when all this began, so maybe I was a little naive. But I still, even though, once I did retire, I wrote the book, to basically maybe express some of my frustrations. And also did some teaching, adjunct teaching at the local university. Yep. And began teaching many of the topics that are in the book. And that's what really led me to writing the book. I thought it was a great idea to kind of link my past experience with my teaching experience and try to get the word out there that you had mentioned, it's a system that tends to be resistant to change. Talking about the educational system.
Yeah. Now, to be clear, the teachers have been great. The teachers have usually really embraced our techniques, really encouraged it. I actually just got an email the other day about a summer school program we're doing, again, paid for by the parents. But the system itself, the curriculum, the administrators, those sorts of things have turned into kind of a, it's known as a blob, right?
Right. I think what you really run into, too, is you run into the tradition of education, where people were really led to believe for many years that certain things in education really worked. And, this self-reporting perception was always hard to dispute because you would hear from the educators themselves. For example, right in my first chapter, I talk about class size. Mm-hmm. But more recently, over at least the last 10 or 15 years, as we became a little bit more sophisticated with data and we've done more research, we find out that class size itself is not a major variable in determining whether or not kids learn.
Right. It's a major variable in determining whether or not a teacher like needs to drink a lot at the end of the day because they're dealing with their terrible class size. But it's not a big determinant in skill. You can have a talented student that excels in that environment. Sometimes some of the data I've looked into this, the data on it is that some students actually excel in a bigger class size because they can be more solitary and work on their own work without being right. distracted.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point. And also there may be more opportunities to learn from others as size increases. You're correct about that. So mm-hmm. what you're really saying is what I really believe in as well. And that is you got to take into consideration the individual differences of the composition of your classroom. And that can be a challenge, particularly in today's world where we have a wide range of different learners. And we also have different backgrounds of learners, different ethnicities of learners, different beliefs and places that they all come from. And this becomes a major challenge for the teacher.
Yeah, well, it also is the system has lots of different backgrounds. I used to describe it to my students this way and say that, you know, the people who make the curriculum, we're talking K through 12, you know, sure. and make some of the guidelines, those are not the C students when they were in high school. Those were the quote unquote browners, right? And we know where the brown comes from, being a browner. So they loved school at that level. Sure. They loved it. So they don't see, like, and this is actually explained to me by administrators, like they just don't see that the system needs to be changed. They think that it's a fair system and the people who are left out are really not the best of the best. Now we know from data, that's not true, but it's right. a bias that continues.
Yeah, there may, you know, 2 points on that. You know, number one, the policymakers in general, and particularly at the state level, may certainly come from that kind of a background, but also need to get into the buildings to see how what they're legislating impacts kids. Mm. They need to talk to the teachers. They need to talk to the people on the front line, so to speak. They need to
talk to the parents.
And the parents. I mean, there's many stakeholders involved here. And you really need to hear from all of them. And sometimes that clearly doesn't happen. In fact, most of the time that doesn't happen with the policy. Mm-hmm.
You know, the Japanese system, Japanese and German systems are often cited as really the pinnacle of measurable results. And one of the things that people don't realize about the Japanese system is it's not as much of a factory system as we have here. You can explain the factory system if you like. But it's very much interactive with the parents. The parents and the teachers talk constantly, and it allows the teacher to customize learning to a tremendous extent. And the curriculum is also all evidence-based. It's like if you have a fact or a figure here or there, if you have a lesson, this one comes before this one, there's a reason for it, and the data tells you the reason, not someone's opinion or someone's tenure or something like that.
You know, the whole question regarding, let me go back to parents because you're making some great points. You know, one of the things here about parents is, one of the things that I always preached was that the parents are really the first teachers of their children. Mm-hmm. And the parents really do know best. And teachers have to be willing to accept that they don't know everything about every child in their classroom until they've spoken to the parents. Mm-hmm. And even parents of kids that they're having challenges with in their classroom still know their kids best. Mm. And all parents only want the best for their child. Every parent, I don't care what their background is, where those parents came from, I don't care where or how parents were successful or not when they were in school, you need to include the parents. It's so critical. And you need to include, again, you know, all parents. So certainly I would reinforce that. Secondly, our system, our K-12 educational system, and perhaps the people that make up that system, are still somewhat resistant to use data. And I think that's a central point because now, yeah, there are many evidence-based programs that are supported by data, but you have to be willing to look at the data, you have to be willing to trust the data, and you have to know how to challenge the data. And that's something that maybe needs to take place in our pre-teaching programs, in other words, at the college and university level, where we need to help prospective teachers understand that data can help them in making decisions about students and programs that are being used in their schools. And that's something that's probably lacking, and that also needs to take place in the teacher preparation program.
Oh, yeah. Well, what role do you think the unions play as part of the problem? That's often been cited as the reason why they're not using data, because they're afraid the data will show that they suck, you know, and somebody needs to get fired, you know?
Yeah, you know, by the way, one of the things I really learned when I talk about teachers' unions, and of course when I was a superintendent, you know, this was a sensitive subject. I mean, these are the people that I would be negotiating with for contracts, et cetera, you know? But one thing I've learned early on, and I still to this day reinforce it within myself, you need to separate out teachers from the unions. In other words, the unions have one agenda or multiple agendas, whatever the case may be. That may not be the same agenda that your classroom teacher has. And once you begin to separate that out, you can begin viewing teachers differently and begin viewing unions differently. You know, class size, by the way, is a great example of how the teachers' unions get involved, and possibly within their own self-interest. You know, the lower you reduce class size, what does that tell you? If I have an average class size of 25 or 24, and I want to-
You need more teachers.
You need more teachers, exactly right. That's my point. So it may not be in the best interest of children that they're pushing that agenda forward. It may be in their own best interests.
Well, and that's the thing. How many times do you think parents, you know, believe that an educational decision, whether it's the superintendent or whatever, was made to benefit the system rather than benefit the students?
Yeah, the parents usually think it's meant to benefit the children, you know, the students in the system. But I got to tell you, more often than not, that's not always the case. The case is the example that I just gave you, where more teachers. You know what happens when you have more teachers? The union becomes stronger when you have more teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And just really to continue on that point, because this may be a good time to point that out. Teacher evaluations in general always receive a lot of resistance, and they receive a lot of resistance from the union, not from the teachers. Teachers want to know how they're doing. But it's a resistance from the union, because what happens is, as you begin to sort teachers from, say, highly effective to satisfactory, when you begin to categorize them, you actually, in an unintended way, if you will, make the union weaker, because not everybody's the same.
So not everybody can be represented the same and negotiate.
Exactly. The union wants everybody the same. The union will tell you that everybody's a good teacher. And that, you know, that solidifies the union in terms of its membership. Everybody's on the same page. You're as good as the person sitting next to you. We're not going to differentiate between people. That weakens our mission. We're going to keep everybody the same.
You know, what's really ironic is that, you know, if you look at this whole thing objectively, I often think if I was explaining this to a space alien who just arrived or something, right, it would seem absolutely absurd that the people whose job it is to grade you on a curve based on your competence are refusing to be graded on a curve based on their competence.
Exactly. You know it's interesting too, when you look at the different generation of teachers, and you've heard so much about the millennial generation, you know, lately.
They're more open to being graded, aren't they? They're more open to meritocracy.
Hey, you took the words out of my mouth. They are willing to look at themselves as individuals. They're even willing to look at issues regarding seniority, issues regarding post-secondary graduate courses, even compensation they're willing to look at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, millennials have a problem understanding that a 20-year teacher who checks in and checks out every day, and maybe you would challenge whether or not they're highly effective, and here's a new teacher, also a math teacher in this case, for example, who comes in early every morning, stays late every afternoon, is on the phone at night with parents, and when it comes to layoffs, you know, last in, first out, the new teacher goes.
Mm-hmm.
The new teacher goes. And they come to my office. I remember them coming to my office, not understanding. And they would say to me, I've done everything possible. How come I'm leaving?
And what that does is it breeds mediocrity when you treat people like that on any basis other than merit and effort. Then it basically discourages anyone from putting out effort. And it amazes me how many teachers are putting out so much effort that is not only unrewarded, but it's punished sometimes. You know, they're coming up with rap songs for math, and there's all these great stories of these hero teachers who essentially are taking a pay cut or working extra for free because they care about the students, you know?
I mean, think about the new teacher, you know, that I just explained, and there's reduction in staff, and it's seniority, last in, first out. They're sitting in my, I'm losing potentially a great teacher who's done a good job over, say, 2 years, but we may also be losing a teacher as to that person's career. In other words, that person may, you talk about being discouraged, you know, here's somebody working very hard, extremely motivated, loves kids, stays up late at night doing lessons, and now they're told they don't have a job. Why would they go then to another district, work another 2 years, and risk the same thing happening? So here you have, you're losing people to the profession that need to be there while we're holding on at the same time to people who maybe should be on their way out.
Do you know how many people I know that work in marketing now and used to be teachers? It's incredible. They go to a place where their extra effort is going to be rewarded.
Right.
And so you're creating a system where the best and the brightest do not get rewarded. And I don't know why that's such a controversial statement. You know, I don't know how the teachers' unions have manufactured politics to such an extent that it's even controversial to say that you should pay people what they're worth. Like, I don't understand how that has become a controversial hot button issue that people even disagree on. I don't even get that.
You know, the current generation of teachers, and again, the younger teachers, the millennial teachers, the Generation X teachers, the union leadership is still led by baby boomers for the most part.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately what you're going to see is you need the current teachers to emerge as the leaders of the unions. And I think once you have different leadership in place, and that's going to happen just basically through attrition. I mean, baby boomers cannot last forever in these positions or in the teaching career either. I think then you'll begin to see some change. You know, it's like everything else.
I don't know. I mean, do you think that it's a generational thing, or do you think people change as they get older? You know, when you're younger, it's in your best interest to make the argument that you deserve more, to put up more effort. But when you're older, it's in your best interest to talk about seniority, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, because those people certainly don't want to be losing their jobs.
So. Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, I hate to sound, you know, pessimistic, but I mean, the more things change, the more they stay the same. There is an incentive for those at the top to solidify their position and to fight others from gaining ground.
You know, I think you've seen kind of an attack on unions, not just teachers' unions, you know, over the last 5 or 10 years, union membership tends to be down, you know, during that course of time. People say that, you know, we're out to attack unions. But I really do believe that as the new people do come up through the ranks, they do see things differently. And they will try to set their own agenda. I mean, right now, my former teachers union president told me that he had a hard time getting the young people to come to the union meetings.
Yeah.
Meaning, for them, the agenda was so irrelevant.
Well, you do have a good point. I mean, it could also be social media and just technology in general. Like the education system is so far behind in terms of payment. Like, they're still looking at it in an early 1900s model, when the real economy, the private sector, has gone through, has not only abandoned that, it's abandoned the two or three models it had after that. And now the future is the gig economy. Like, you're not just going to be judged based on your performance over the course of a year, but this one task that you're doing, you're paid for this one task and nothing else. The gig economy is the future in a lot of ways. A lot of people don't like it. A lot of people, you know, love it because of the freedom. But I don't know how that'll apply to teaching, but I can see that affecting, like, psychologically, you know, the teachers would be like, well, I did this one thing really well. I want to get rewarded for it. Like right. Down to that minutia that right. The unions and the system are so unprepared to even have that conversation.
Absolutely. You know, you talk about things, you know, remaining the same. You know, when you said that before, you triggered something in me. Yeah, I don't know when you graduated high school, how many years ago, but certainly I graduated high school many, many more years earlier than you did. And I got to tell you.
I appreciate that. Thanks. Now I feel a little, I work with a bunch of millennials. I feel old most of the time.
I feel old. Believe me, some days I feel very old. But my point is, when you go back, and I used to visit the buildings all the time, of course, but when you go back, maybe as an outsider, to visit the buildings, you don't see much change. You know, your classroom is still looking the same. Yes, it may be infused with technology here or there, and maybe the chairs aren't in a row. Maybe they're in quads, you know, or, you know.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Actually, I'll tell you from personal experience, I did my second Guinness record attempt, a successful attempt, at my former high school. Because we needed to have people who are upstanding in the community. It turns out teachers could sign off on a Guinness record. And it was a fun thing for the school to be involved in. So I did it there. And you're right. That was in 2009. I graduated with 96, right? So nothing much changed in that whole time.
Exactly. And I'm telling you, I'm a lot older than you are. And I can tell you nothing has changed. Now, from somebody that's been in the system all those years, and the system is still configured the same way. You know, we have the elementary school.
Well, it's referred to as the factory system. You heard of that? It's the factory model.
Exactly right. It's an industrial revolution model. It's like putting together a car. You know, you build the basic skills K to 3, and they become more sophisticated, you know, in middle school. And then you exit with the complete product at 12th grade. It's that industrial model of putting the automobile together piece by piece. And at the end, you ride it off the assembly line.
And a lot of people don't realize that that is not the only model of education at that level. You know, going back to the ancient Greeks of a more interactive model, looking at, you know, places like Germany, which have project-based models a lot, and a lot of wonderful experiments happening in charter schools where a school will, it'll be your project to work on something. The idea of having everybody in a cube in one room, you know, teacher lecturing, and then the quiz happens. It just doesn't create the type of people that this economy needs. And time and time again, you see that.
You know, just to link the charter schools to something you said earlier, charter schools and parents are very involved.
Yeah.
In fact, in many instances, that's part of the charter, that the parents be involved in the school. The nice thing about charter schools, and certainly, as you know, this is a resistance of unions in general, because teachers, they typically don't have union representation. But the nice part about charter schools that I've always thought of anyway was that it gives parents choice. You know, many times parents, you send your child to where your zip code is. This is where you live. You have no choice. It's one of the few things in our democracy where there is no choice, and that is education. You live here, you go to school here. Your schools are bad, too bad. That's where the kids have to go to school. But at least charter schools empower the parents initially anyway by saying you have a choice. You can go to your local public school or you can come to a charter school, which, as you know, is a public school anyway.
Yeah, but just to wrap this up, tell me where you think things are headed. You've seen this trend for many, many years. Do you think there's going to be there's a lot of people in Silicon Valley, for example, who say that there's going to be an internet solution for education. There's a lot of supplementary programs. I've got my child in Kumon, you know, and they're doing even better there than they do in the regular school system. So what is the future? Tell me, give me a crystal ball.
I really do think that choice is going to have to be a factor where children go to school and the involvement of parents in making that decision. That's number one. I think time needs to become a variable. I don't think time is a variable right now. In other words, you go to school from September to June. You go to school, 9 to 3. Your school day ends. I think time has to become something that becomes flexible. And I think students, for the most part, will have that opportunity. And I think technology will make that possible to learn when they want to learn, not necessarily when they have to learn. And that's where time will become something that's manipulated and no longer a standard factor. It will become a variable, something that's flexible. Why can't we learn in July and August? I mean, why do schools have to be closed in July and August?
Well, and there's also some schools that are experimenting with a 4-day week as well, again, for budget cutbacks and unions and things like that. But, there's data that shows that it has potential. But I think, you're right. This next generation, I think the school system, of course, took the longest of any other part of the economy. Everyone else. It reminds me of, when I still have to fax something to the IRS. It's like, yeah, eventually they're going to catch up to the rest of the world. But I think the school system took the longest, but it is starting to change. And you're right with the next generation that they won't be able to ignore this for very long. They're going to have to change and catch up. And I think we're going to see some really exciting things over the next 10 years.
I really do. And I believe also, too, that while the generation of teachers will be part of that change, I think the generation of students that we currently have will be part of that change, too. They will be demanding something different. Something that was developed, as you said, during the Industrial Revolution cannot be relevant anymore. It just doesn't make any sense. So I think you'll have a demand for change coming from many, many different areas. And ultimately, yeah, maybe within the next decade, we'll see some of that change, including more online learning.
That's fantastic. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on the show, Philip. You're definitely a brains behind this this subject.
Definitely a pleasure meeting you. I enjoyed the conversation. Would love to do it again.
Awesome.
Thank you for listening to The Brains Behind It. And remember to check out brainhackers.com for more. If you have a suggestion for the next interview or comment, please email editor@brainhackers.com. If you want a free 30-minute marketing consultation from Dave Farrow and his team, then email editor@brainhackers.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.